He's had that kingdom purpose really since the beginning of time. And God's kingdom purpose was to make Jesus his king. Now, he did that by doing a lot of things kind of along the way. God has always been and always will continue to be the king. He reigns in the physical world, the world we all live in, and he also reigns in a spiritual world, a world that Christians are aware of, but we can't see it. It exists. There's no question that it exists, but it's just something that we can't see. We kind of get caught up thinking about the physical world. And I suppose that's understandable, since that's the world that we can see. And sometimes when we look at the world that we can see, it looks like Satan and the evil that he inspires is ruling the day. It doesn't always look like God is in charge. There's a story that is recorded for us in the book of Judges, Judges 18. And we just studied this with Ron Harrison. But that story, I think, rings true for a lot of us. It's a story about a man named Micah. The Danites, a group of individuals among whom he was living, decided that they were going to come to Micah's house and they were just going to take the things that Micah had. Now, there's a lot that we could say about whether Micah should have had the things in his house that he had in his house. We're not going to focus on that. We're just going to focus on the fact this morning that Micah had some things in his house. The Danites came and they took it. And then Micah had to deal with the fact that it looked like evil was in charge. This is the way the record reads in Judges 18. And beginning at about verse 27, it says, "Then they took what Micah had made and his priest, and they went on to Laish, against a people at peace and secure." The Danites, they then attacked the people of Laish with the sword and burned down their city. There was no one to rescue them because they lived a long way from Sidon and they had no relationship with anybody else. They had no treaties. The city was in a valley near Beth Rehob. The Danites rebuilt the city and settled there. They named it Dan after their ancestor Dan, who was born to Israel, though the city used to be called Laish. You remember what happened? Micah went out and confronted them. He asked them why they had taken all of the things that they had taken. And their response essentially was, shut up and sit down, or we'll do worse. You know, I say that rings true because I was thinking about what was going on when there were riots here in Eugene. People that owned businesses went to their businesses and said, why are you doing this? You're just burning down my business. And they tried to stop it. And they were, it just seems like they're powerless because evil men had decided that they were going to burn down their business. Now, that's not to say that people didn't have some reasonable things to say that were saying them at about that same time, but these were evil men. This wasn't somebody trying to make a political point. They were just burning down businesses. Same thing happened in Judges, the 19th chapter. This time it happened to an old man from the hill country of Ephraim. Well, let's just read the story. Judges, the 19th chapter. We begin at verse 22. A Levite has come and is staying in the house of this old man from the hill country of Ephraim. And the record picks up. It says, while they were enjoying themselves, some of the wicked men of the city surrounded the house. Pounding on the door, they shouted to the old man who owned the house, bring out the man who came to your house so we can have sex with him. The owner of the house went outside and he said to them, no, my friends, don't be so vile. Since this man is my guest, don't do this outrageous thing. Look, here's my virgin daughter and his concubine. I'll bring them out to you so you can use them and do with them whatever you wish. But as for this man, don't do such an outrageous thing. The men would not listen to him. So the man took his concubine and sent her outside to them. They raped her. They abused her throughout the night, and at dawn they let her go. She went to her house and died. You know, sometimes it just seems like evil is overwhelming, and there's nothing that we can do to stop it. I worked with people who were incarcerated for a little while, and one of the things that I learned in the prison system is might makes right. A prisoner wants what you have, you're a prisoner as well, and he just comes and takes it. You try to stop him, and he beats you senseless. If you don't try to stop him, he considers that consent. He no longer thinks of it as stealing because you've said it's okay for him to have it since you didn't stop him. Now that's the extreme, but that's what happened with the Danites. Just shut up and sit down. And yeah, I have been afraid to put up an American flag in my front yard because I didn't know what was going to happen. Now, I do have an American flag that flies in my front yard. Nothing has happened. But I will admit that it scared me to put it up. God is always in charge. He is always the king. Even when he's unseen and he's unacknowledged. Think about the way that the stories in Judges both begin. In Judges, the 18th chapter, it begins the same way it begins in Judges 19:1. In those days, Israel had no king. David was anointed to be the king, even though it looked like Saul. And the evil that Saul was doing was in charge. It's just a reminder that God is in reality in charge. In 1 Samuel, the 16th chapter, Samuel goes to anoint David king. Now, even Samuel, a man after God's heart, was worried that the evil men, Saul's minions, would see what he was doing and that he would suffer because of it. But let's read the stories. 1 Samuel 16, beginning at verse 1. The Lord said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul? It bothered Samuel that Saul had rejected God, because God said, I have rejected him as king over Israel. Now, it still looked like Saul was king, but he'd been rejected by God. So God said, fill your horn with oil and be on your way. I'm sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I've chosen one of his sons to be king. Samuel said, how can I go? If Saul hears about it, he'll kill me. The Lord said, take a heifer with you and say, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I'll show you what to do. You're to anoint for me the one who I indicate." Samuel did what the Lord said. When he arrived at Bethlehem, the elders of the town trembled when they met him. They said, "Do you come in peace?" Samuel replied, "Yes, in peace. I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come to the sacrifice with me." Then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. And when they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord." Eliab was Jesse's oldest son. The Lord said to Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height. I've rejected him." The Lord does not look on things that people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Jesse called Abinadab and had him pass in front of Samuel. Samuel said, "The Lord has not chosen this one either." Jesse then had Shammah pass by, but Samuel said, "Nor has the Lord chosen this one." Jesse had seven of his sons pass before Samuel, but Samuel said to him, "The Lord has not chosen these." So he asked Jesse, "Are these all the sons you have?" Jesse answered, "They're still the youngest. He's tending the sheep." Samuel said, "Send for him. We'll not sit down until he arrives." So he sent for him, had him brought in. He was glowing with health, had a fine appearance, handsome features. The Lord said, "Rise and anoint him. This is the one." So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. And from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon David. Samuel then went to Ramah. David was in Saul's service for a long time. It looked like Saul was still king, but David was the anointed one. The Spirit of the Lord, it continues, had departed from Saul. An evil spirit from the Lord tormented him. You know, even when we acknowledge God as being king, sometimes it's in this world that we live in, it's still hard to see it. I think about the prophet Habakkuk. Habakkuk is a great story. Habakkuk reasons with God. Habakkuk was seeing a lot of things going on in Israel that should not have been going on. The rich men were oppressing the poor men. They were stealing women's houses, widows' houses. It just seemed like nothing was the way it should be. Habakkuk goes to God and he says, "God, how long am I going to have to look at this?" Essentially, he says to God, "You're supposed to be in charge. How long are you going to let this go on?" And God said to Habakkuk, "I will work a work in your days, and you won't believe it even though I'm telling you about it. I will raise up the Babylonians. They're a bitter and hasty nation, but they are going to execute my judgment on Israel." Habakkuk reasonably responded to God. He said, "Wait a minute, God, I wasn't expecting anything quite that drastic." But God continued with Habakkuk, and he said, I'll take care of the people that still serve me. But I just want you to see that even though Habakkuk knew, recognized, acknowledged God, he still had a hard time saying that God was in charge. And the fact is, God is in charge. Some people will say that they want to do what God wants them to do, but they really don't. Ezekiel, the 14th chapter, is a story about some of the elders in Israel that didn't want to do what God wanted them to do. In essence, they had set idols up in their heart. They had already predetermined the course that they were going to follow. And then they came to Ezekiel and they asked Ezekiel the question, is God going to bless us? So there's this conversation between Ezekiel and God about that situation recorded in Ezekiel 14. Beginning at verse 1, it says, some of the elders of Israel came to me. They sat down in front of me. Then the word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, that's what God called Ezekiel. Son of man, these men have set up idols in their hearts. They put wicked stumbling blocks before their faces. Should I let them inquire of me at all? Therefore, speak to them. Tell them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. When any of the Israelites set up idols in their hearts and put a wicked stumbling block before their faces and then go to a prophet, I, the Lord, will answer them myself. But get this, he says, I will answer them in keeping with their great idolatry. I'll do this to recapture the hearts of the people of Israel who've all deserted me for their idols. Therefore, say to the people of Israel, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Repent, turn from your idols, renounce all your detestable practices. When any of the Israelites or any foreigner residing in Israel separate themselves from me and set up idols in their hearts and put a wicked stumbling block before their faces and then go to a prophet to inquire of me, I, the Lord, will answer them myself. I'll set my face against them. I'll make them an example and a byword. They'll be a meme. That's the best way to say it. I'll remove them from my people. Then you'll know that I'm the Lord. If the prophet is enticed to utter a prophecy, I, the Lord, have enticed the prophet. I'll stretch out my hand against him and destroy him from among my people Israel. They'll bear their guilt. The prophet will be as guilty as the one who consults him. Then the people of Israel will no longer stray from me, nor will they defile themselves anymore with all their sins. They'll be my people and I'll be their God, declares the sovereign Lord. But you can't predetermine what you're going to do and then ask the Lord, because the Lord says, I'll just answer you any old way. It doesn't really matter because you've already figured out what you're going to do. In 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter, beginning at verse 10, Samuel told the word of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. You remember, Israel had not had a physical king up until the time that Samuel anointed Saul to be the king. And they came to Samuel, they said, we want a king. We want to be like the nations that are around us. Now that disturbed Samuel a great deal, and he talked to God about it. And we have the record of his discussion with God. Samuel said, this is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He'll take your sons, make them serve his chariots and horses. They'll run in front of his chariots. Some he'll assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, others to plow his ground and reap his harvest. Others will make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He'll take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He'll take the best of your fields and vineyards and offer and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He'll take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officials and his attendants. Your male and female servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He'll take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When the day comes, you'll cry out for relief from the king you have chosen. But the Lord will not answer you in that day. The people refused to listen to Samuel. He was right, but the people refused to listen. They wanted a king. And Samuel was not going to dissuade them from that desire to have a king. They said, we want a king over us. Then we'll be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and go out before us and fight our battles. When Samuel heard all that, he repeated it before the Lord. The Lord answered, listen to them, give them a king. They didn't really want to inquire of God. In fact, God had been rejected, but God was never dethroned. Now, I kind of let that sink in for a minute. God was rejected, but he was never dethroned. In 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter, this is a little bit before the story we just read. In verse 6, it says, when they said, give us a king to lead us, it displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord. The Lord told him, listen to all that the people are saying to you. It's not you they've rejected. They've rejected me as their king. They've done from the, as they have done from the day that I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they're doing this to you. This is really nothing new. Now, listen to them, warn them solemnly, and let them know what the king who will reign over them will claim as his rights. So God's purpose was always to be in charge, to crown Jesus to be the king, but it took Jesus dying on the cross to accomplish his kingship. Now that's an incredible statement. It took Jesus dying on the cross to be the kind of king that God was trying to establish all along. Isaiah, the 9th chapter, beginning at verse 6, the prophet says, unto us a child is born, to us a son is given. The government will be upon his shoulders. He'll be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace there'll be no end. He will reign on David's throne over his kingdom, establishing it and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on forever. The zeal of the Lord will accomplish this, but in Acts, the 2nd chapter, after the people of Israel had put Jesus on the cross, this is what Peter said. He was a prophet, and he knew, of course, now he's talking about David. He was a prophet. He knew that God had promised him with an oath that he would place one of his descendants on his throne. That was the promise we read, Isaiah 9. Seeing what was to come, David spoke of the resurrection of the Messiah, that he was not abandoned to the realm of the dead, nor did his body see decay. God has raised this Jesus to life, and he now sits on his throne. Ephesians, the 1st chapter, beginning at verse 18. This is Paul's prayer. I pray that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened in order that you may know the hope to which he has called you, the riches of his glorious inheritance in his holy people, and his incomparably great power for us who believe. That power that we need to be aware of, that power is the same as the mighty strength he exerted when he raised Jesus from the dead and seated him at his own right hand in the heavenly places. far above all ruler and rule and authority, all power and dominion, every name that is invoked, not only in this present age, but also in that which is to come. Now, if you go back and you read just a little bit earlier in Acts, the first chapter, you read about how Jesus, having been to the cross, put to death, raised from the dead, then ascended to his Father. The apostles were amazed when they saw all of that. Daniel, the seventh chapter, at verse 13 beginning, describes this from the other perspective. Acts 1 is from the perspective of what's going on here on the earth. Daniel, the seventh chapter, is a perspective of what is going on from heaven's vantage point. And he says, I saw Jesus come to the Ancient of Days. We saw him leave. Daniel describes where he went. And he sat down at the right hand of God. He is King. Now you read about it over and over and over again in the book of Revelation. The King, in Revelation 19, beginning at verse 13, he is described as one whose robe is dipped in blood. You see, in order for Jesus to really be the King, he had to go to the cross. So now, what's that mean to me? What's my kingdom focus? Well, it's pretty simple. Acknowledge him as the King. The picture that you have before you is a picture of the crown jewels that are on display in London. You know, we don't have a king, and we don't understand a lot about what's involved in having a king. We don't tend to think of ourselves as being subjects. But what that means is he has to rule in my life. And that's a big, big statement. It's a lot more than simple moral therapeutic deism. Now that's a big phrase. It comes from some work that was done by sociologists who were trying to characterize most religious thought today. Their names were Christian Smith and Melissa Lindquist Denton. They wrote a book called Soul Searching: The Religious and Spiritual Lives of American Teenagers. They were writing about American teens, but it's the same thing that characterizes us. And those two researchers, when they tried to describe religious thought that was entertained by most people in America, described it this way. They coined the phrase moral therapeutic deism, but that phrase really refers to five core precepts, five core principles. First, there's a God who created order in the world and watches over human life on earth. That's kind of the deism part of it. God wants people to be good and nice and fair to each other, as taught in the Bible and by most world religions. That's kind of the moral part of it. Number three, the central goal of life, this is what most people believe in terms of religion. The central goal of life is to be happy and to feel good about oneself. That's the therapeutic part. God does not need to be particularly involved in anyone's life except when God is needed to answer a problem. And finally, the fifth principle that most people believe, good people go to heaven when they die. Think about this very carefully. I can't stress how important this is enough. None of those core statements, none of those five statements that I just gave you, none of them requires that Jesus die in order to establish a kingdom. Moral therapeutic deism replaces reduces Jesus to really nothing more than a good moral teacher. Perhaps the greatest moral teacher who has an enduring relevance. The sacrificial aspects of Jesus are stripped away. Catch that carefully. The sacrificial aspects of Jesus are stripped away. The cross becomes an embarrassment. Far from seeing him as our master, this modern age transforms Jesus into a mascot. The one who affirms our favored causes and affirms us in our deepest selves, where we find ourselves defined by our desire to be happy. We're imprisoned by our very selves. We become slaves to our passions, even making them the determinant of our true identity. They go on to point out the language and therefore the experience of Trinity, of holiness, of sin, grace, justification, sanctification, the church, even heaven and hell, appear among most Christian teenagers in the United States at the very least to be supplanted or replaced by a language of happiness, niceness, and an earned heavenly reward. The radical change replaces the sovereignty of God with the sovereignty of self. In this therapeutic picture, human problems are reduced to pathologies and therefore they need a treatment plan. Sin is excluded from that picture. The wrath and justice of God are described as out of step with the times. They're unhelpful to the project of self-realization. In gravitating to this idea, young people have been observing their parents interact with the larger culture. And they've done it with diligence, and they're very insightful. The reason that they believe what they believe is because we taught them that. They understand how little the older generation really believes and how much churches have accommodated themselves to the dominant culture. They sense the degree to which theological conviction has been sacrificed on the altar of individualism and relativism and a relative understanding of truth. They learn from their elders that self-improvement is the one great moral imperative to which they are all accountable. They have observed the fact that the highest aspiration of those who shape this culture is to find happiness, security, and meaning in life. And what that means is that we face the daunting challenge of evangelizing a nation that largely considers itself Christian, quote unquote, overwhelmingly believes in some deity, considers itself fervently religious, but has no connection to authentic Christianity. So how do we acknowledge Jesus as King? How do we give him a rightful place in our lives? You know, I have a tendency to read some statements that Jesus makes. If your right hand offends you, cut it off. It's better to enter into heaven with one hand than having two hands to go into hell. And my first response to that is to say, well, Jesus really didn't say, cut off your hand. I don't find myself trying to understand what Jesus really meant. That seems harsh. You have to love me more than you love your parents. If you love brother or sister more than me, you're not worthy of me. My first response is to say, whoa, wait a minute, it can't mean that. I have to soften it. I'm not willing to let Jesus be King. That's really what it means. I have to listen to Jesus without having a predetermined course. Romans, the first chapter, verse 28, therefore, or furthermore, just as they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, God gave them over to a depraved mind to do what ought not to be done. If we give up on God and we have a predetermined course, we will not have Jesus as our King. And then I guess this is the point at which all of this becomes very encouraging. Because if Jesus really is the King, I can live fearlessly. I do not have to be afraid of the evil that looks like it's ruling in the world. Jesus sent out his apostles. And in Matthew 10 at verse 28, he said, do not be afraid of those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell. I don't have to be afraid. It looks like Satan is in control, but it's just an illusion. God is really the one who is in control. In 1 Corinthians 4, beginning at verse 5, the apostle says, judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait until the Lord comes. It looks one way now, but trust me, it's not that way, and God is coming. And he'll set it right. He says he'll bring to light what's hidden in the darkness. He'll expose the motives of the heart. At that time, each will receive their praise from God. Proverbs, the 29th chapter, and at verse 25. Is a statement that I want to conclude with because it's a statement that I think paralyzes me. Maybe it paralyzes you. The wise man said, fear of man will prove to be a snare. Yes. But whoever trusts in the Lord is kept safe. There's the promise. Let God be king. Don't settle for something less than that. But look at God's kingdom mission and make that your kingdom focus. That's what we need to do. And boy, do I want to be a part of that kingdom. Now, we'll keep talking about some things that characterize that kingdom. And we'll draw some comparisons in the future. But if you want to be part of that kingdom, you're going to have to think about it in terms of the sacrifice that Jesus made for sin. I'm not calling upon you this morning to be a nice person. I'm not calling upon you to be a great American. That's nothing more than moral therapeutic deism. I'm calling on you to be something that you can only be because Jesus died. I don't need Jesus' death to be a good person. I do need it to be a kingdom citizen. So if you want to be a part of that kingdom, it means you're going to have to put on Jesus' death. There's probably a reason why baptism is the way that it is. You let someone else put the old man to death, bury you in water, and raise you to walk in newness of life. You can't do that yourself. We want to help you do that if that's what you want. But we want you to think about it.